Hello and welcome back to the Cosmic Library, where you can read the greatest stories in all of the multiverse. I am Jeremy.
And I am Jesse.
We are doing this show in conjunction with Second Union. For more of the latest headlines and entertainment, please go to our website at wearesecondunion.com. Unfortunately, Joanna is not feeling well this evening, so it's just the guys tonight. Jesse, how are you? Holiday still bearing down on you?
No, not as much, but I'm just like, it's finally winter.
I wish I would get rain, though. Down here, we haven't seen any yet.
We just got like 3 days worth of it.
Oh, you're lucky. Now, I finished my Christmas shopping already. I got all the stuff here. I just have to put in fancy paper to be torn apart. That almost feels like a metaphor in some way. But other than that, you know, it's pretty basic. Nothing really serious is happening right now. I'm looking forward to tomorrow's comic book releases. Last week, the first issue of Sword finally dropped. We've been talking about that one for months. And I gotta admit, after I read it, I was intrigued. It was not what I thought it was going to be. Did you check it out?
No. But we all thought it was going to be some like intergalactic thing, but well, after what happened with the X of Swords.
Yeah, I mean, it is an intergalactic thing. Sword has been reinstalled, and it seems to be entirely occupied by mutants for the time being, which is fine. And it appears in addition to doing what Sword used to do, this new version, they're exploring even further. By the end of the issue, they took something from I almost want to say an interstellar cosmic forge. I think they went to the origin point of the universe and grabbed something. And they did this by combining the teleportation powers of six people combined with Fabian Cortez to basically send them further and into a more remote location than human beings have ever traveled before. And then due to the combination of their powers, they went deep into this forge and took an object, which it's this black pyramid, which we saw in the teaser image for Reign of X, something Storm was holding. So I'm curious what this object is. I'm curious why they felt like they needed to do this. And then it occurs to me, how much further can they go with this? Not the story. I mean, how much further can the characters of Sword go in their new exploration? And what's the end goal? Why do you need cosmic forge items? So I was left with a bunch of questions, but I was intrigued. It's a gorgeous comic, too. It's really nice. And, you know, other than that, the latest Batman story, which is now put on hold for the future state release next month, that finally finished up. I was actually rather disappointed there. They'd been setting up what I thought was going to be a new nemesis for Batman and Gotham City in the form of the Ghostmaker, and by the end of the first storyline involving these characters, they've already agreed to work together in Gotham, and I don't know about be buddies, but definitely allies. It's supposed to be Ghostmaker's job to tell Batman when he thinks he's doing it wrong. Which, according to Batman, is like something he hasn't had since Alfred died, and I'm trying to think, because it's like, you know, I always thought Alfred did his best to bring out the best in you. Now you're asking your murderous rival to do the same thing. I have a conflict here.
Isn't that what the Robins were supposed to have done?
I thought so. You know, I mean, if you want, we can chat about it in the middle of the news and everything, because I don't want to bore everybody right here in the preamble, but by the end of it, I just remember thinking, I think we wasted like 2 years worth of stories in two issues. I had a bizarre moment this morning while I was reading the comic.
Say a lot of things, but it is ending coming back to the same thing, just with different coats of paint.
You know, I think that's part of my problem, is that was the feeling I had, was that, okay, so the beat goes on. It really didn't even change tempo. The only thing, I guess they added a trumpet track to it, but that's about it. So I'm going to have to put some thought into that one. But the subject of this week is actually Batman and Gotham City. This is going to be more of not a theoretical conversation, but just a conversation about how the city is supposed to function in both DC and real-world terms. But we will get to that after the news of the week. And we're going to start with Marvel Comic News. We will talk about the characters and intellectual properties, the House of Mouse, and what they have in the upcoming months. I guess the miniseries revolving around the origin of the Hulk alter ego Maestro is going better than I expected. Marvel's already announced that in January, Peter David is going to continue the story of the Maestro in another miniseries titled Maestro, War, and Pax. I guess this is supposed to be the moments he actually conquered the projected future that the Maestro inhabits. It's going to be another limited series with art by Javier Pina. And according to Peter David, quote, the Maestro has determined that life must go on in the world he's living in, and that should be the center of government. He's consolidating his rule. He truly believes he's doing the right thing. After all, he's seen what mankind inevitably does left to its own devices. He thinks that free will has proven to be a noble experiment, but ultimately didn't work out. So now it's time to try something new. And he's what's new, unquote. I mean, I guess we always knew that this was going to lead to some kind of superhero Armageddon, but we're kind of seeing a more step-by-step take than I thought we'd get from a miniseries. Hmm. It's not a bad thing, necessarily. The books tend to be a little bit thicker than I'm used to reading, so I just kind of push them aside while I'm trying to catch up on other stories. I think I need to sit down and read these as a whole once they come out. But you know me, I digest stories better when I have large chunks of them rather than single issues. Meanwhile, the Ghost Rider creation Vengeance is being reunited with one of his longtime creators, Howard Mackey. And Mackey thinks that he and Vengeance have a lot in common, oddly enough.
Okay.
That's a bit of a scary statement. I'm not sure I like that idea.
Need a bit more context in this relationship or this connection.
Well, when Newsarama asked him about the character of Vengeance, Mackey said, quote, in all ways, Bettelino is the third part of a very dark triangle of writers and also a little bit of Howard Mackey writer. Danny Ketch was very much the younger me. He was a kid from Brooklyn who was saddled with a living spirit of vengeance thrust upon him. I hope that's not literally Mackey's story, but okay. He was forced to wrestle with demons, externally and internally. But I think Danny's heart and soul were relatively pure. Thus, he was able to keep the spirit of vengeance under control. Blaze was a little bit more mature and world-weary. He's been to hell and back several times, and that wears away at you. When I was writing Blaze, I felt like he was always struggling to keep things under control. Sometimes he didn't succeed. Bettelino embraced the darkest impulses of being a writer. He looked into the darkness looked back, and there was a union. I find the potential in exploring that kind of character infinitely exciting as a writer. You know, what if Ghost Rider wasn't such a wimp? Unquote. Apparently, Vengeance is making his return in an upcoming one-shot. I'm trying to figure out the right way to say it. I like Ghost Rider stories when they're a little more grounded in the Marvel Universe, when it's often about a lot of demonic imagery and just one of the writers fighting the forces of hell. It tends to get a little repetitive for me personally. But yeah, Vengeance is coming back in the one-shot. Ghost Rider, Return of Vengeance, number one. Return of Vengeance is going on sale this December 30th, both print and digitally.
I'm trying to figure what he defines as being a wimp.
You mean as far as Ghost Rider? I imagine he means how a lot of humans take those spirits of vengeance that are inhabiting them and try and do something better, whereas Bettelino is just like, okay, punish the wicked, let's do this.
Right, okay.
Meanwhile, the comic that's been coming out lately about Shang-Chi, it's currently facing a month delay. The Shang-Chi one-shot, Legend of Shang-Chi, has been delayed by 4 weeks. It's a 32-page special that is pitting Shang-Chi against longtime Daredevil and X-Men villain Lady Deathstrike. But it was originally scheduled to go on sale January 6th. It is now going on sale February 3rd. Doesn't appear to be a reason for this delay. Shang-Chi versus Lady Deathstrike on paper sounds very interesting. I mean, that's a lady who's unarmed but very armed versus a guy who's almost never armed, but at the same time, after reading a few Shang-Chi stories, I think Lady Deathstrike is a bit outmatched.
Hmm.
You know, there's a reason why he is one of the best martial artists in Marvel Comics. Another well-known martial artist in Marvel is getting another delay. Black Widow number 4 came out about a week ago. Unfortunately, Black Widow number 5 has been delayed 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. Let me see. Issue 5 is now going on sale February 15th. The collected version of the first 5 issues of the current Black Widow series is now scheduled to go on sale March 16th. That has not moved from its original date. Kelly Thompson said earlier this month that February would be a skip month for the title, with it returning in March. Apparently now, January is that skip month. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But Kelly Thompson has been promised to work on a 10-issue run of Black Widow comics before Marvel and Disney consider the future of the series. I've read the first 4 issues. I would say it's probably some of the stronger stuff that Marvel has right now, personally. It's been entertaining with a couple of nice mysteries thrown in there. Additionally, some designs have been released in regards to the upcoming Star Wars The High Republic stories. Mm-hmm. These are far-flung prequels to the original Star Wars saga, back to the heyday of the Republic, and probably the earlier days of the Jedi Knights formation. And the design work is much cleaner than I'm used to from a Star Wars story. You know how Star Wars is. Some of it feels like it's clutched together, a lot of it feels dirty, because often it's people on the outer rim of the Republic territory.
Yeah, it's all old.
Right.
And used and worn.
Right, so in this case, the designs that were on the story on IO9 are not quite as angular and slick as what's in the Star Wars films, but it's much cleaner. It feels more like a manufactured future. I sent you the link so you can take a look. The very first ship there looks complicated.
Yeah, it's still got that clutchiness to it, but it's clean.
I don't think it's that clutched as the others. It feels much more bulky. This thing feels like the first ship is definitely like probably a 5-man ship of some sort. Some kind of, I wouldn't say a long-haul ship, but it's definitely something that's made to carry more than a few people to a destination. But it feels more robust.
Not that first one.
Let me see. It's apparently it's a Nihil ship. Now the second one, the Jedi Vector, feels very familiar.
Yes, that's definitely an homage from the prequels.
Yeah. And the third one is Republic Longbeam. So it's a new ship design being debuted. I wouldn't say it's a precursor to Star Destroyers, but it's definitely a long distance carrier.
It's definitely a precursor to a couple of ship designs.
Maybe a Corvette.
Yeah. Or light cruisers, because the engine set was very... The engine set back there, the Empire's used for smaller ships.
Right, and we're supposed to see these designs in the stories revolving around the New Republic, both in comic book and in novel form. I don't recall reading anything about any animated or live-action series based on this thus far. However, I think that one of the new announced shows on Disney Plus, The Acolyte, is supposed to be towards the end of this period.
The Acolyte? Oh.
I think. I'm not absolutely sure. Unfortunately, all those announcements came out like midweek for me, and I was in the middle of work when they dropped all this information. I still haven't even seen the Loki trailer yet, and I meant to go back and do that. Meanwhile, Chris Claremont's anniversary special has been delayed to next year.
Wow.
Claremont was writing a bunch of new original stories based on Marvel properties he already worked on, including The Invisible Woman, Mirage from the New Mutants, Gambit, Binary, and I believe A Very Young Storm. It was originally scheduled to come out this December. However, it's now scheduled to go on sale January 13th, 2021. The publisher did not say why this delay occurred. However, it is known out there that recently Chris Claremont did break his left hand.
Oof.
He broke it in early November, and I don't know if he's a lefty or a righty, so I don't know how important that is.
Well, in regards to this, that's a lot of pain, especially for his age.
Yeah, he's got to be in the late 60s at the youngest, I would believe. This will be a 40-page special with 4 stories. The art is going to be by Bill Sienkiewicz, Sean Chen, Diego Orlotugi, and Brett Booth. Personally, I'm looking forward to it, man. Claremont may not be everyone's cup of tea, but I think he's imaginative as a writer. Last up in Marvel comic news, do you remember the anniversary issue that was released in regards to Giant Size X-Men? The entire script was redone with modern artists, each doing a page of the interiors.
Right, I think I saw an article on my Facebook feed about that.
Yeah, well, it turns out there's going to be another anniversary issue made the same way, except this one is based on two classic stories by Joe Simon, Stan Lee, and Jack Kirby in the Captain America Anniversary Tribute number one.
Right, that's what I saw.
Yeah, Captain America is headed for his 80th anniversary. He was originally released in 1941, and groups of dozens of artists are being assembled to fully redraw the issue. As part of the one shot, the Captain America Tribute number one, they will recreate the Golden Age issue of Captain America's original debut in a modern design. And in addition, the one shot's going to have a recreation of Avengers number 4, which is the first issue that brought Captain America into modern Marvel comics. This was in 1963. I'm kind of on the fence about that. I haven't had an interest in those stories myself, but this would be kind of a way to read a piece of comic book history without actually endangering anything. So, I'm on the fence. You?
I have some strange aversion to watching anything that's old. I don't know why.
Oh, well, that explains why you've never been on my TikTok. Fine. Next up, we have DC Comic News. We'll talk about the other major company in comics and where they're headed now and in the near future. DC has decided to go ahead and drop a bomb ahead of their next event in Future State. They've decided to reveal to us the identity of the next Batman.
Right. Seen articles with that, of that.
Yeah, I mean, they showed snippets and different views of his potential face, and it wasn't enough to really draw down what his identity was. Now they've decided to tell us that the next Batman in this projected future is Tim Fox.
Tim Fox?
Luke Fox's brother.
Oh,
So it's not the
guess.
current Batwing, and it's not Duke Thomas, it's Batwing's brother, Tim. So, not only did DC announce this, they released an image of the cover where Tim will show his face fully. I believe it's Future State number two. Or is it Batman Future State number two? Oh, it's Future State, the next Batman number two by Doug Braithwaite and Diego Rodriguez. Now, if you're looking for the first appearance of Tim Fox, now that you know he's going to be the next Batman, you're going to have to look back in 1979. He originally appeared in Batman number 313 by Len Wein and Irv Novik.
Wow.
Tim's modern day appearances have been occasional. He briefly appeared in Batman number 101 after a 9-year gap, re-emerging as the Fox family is coming together after his father was given the Wayne family fortune following the Joker War and by the actions of Catwoman. So, there was only three potential characters it could be based on the idea that it was an already established character, realistically. You could say four, but something tells me Jon Stewart's never putting on a Batman suit.
Oh, no.
I mean, was it the least likely of the three? Maybe. Is it a huge swerve? I really don't know. I'm just really surprised they allowed this information to drop, because this is the kind of information that sells comic books. Why would you just not wait for the event that starts next month? And I'm asking the question. I really don't know. So, Newsarama put out a follow-up story asking themselves the question, why would you put out this information earlier? And they say it was to sell more comics, because now you know who this character is, and you'll be more interested in the whys. But I don't know. I always thought character reveals like that were half the reason why you bought comics, because you have a big unknown, and you usually are going to get the whys regardless of whether or not people know the character.
Seems like they don't trust the care.
You know, that may be something about it. We've discussed that DC has a little bit of problem when it comes to diversifying their line. Maybe they thought if they put it out there early, people would be more interested to do it, or they were just taking the sting out of it when long-term fanboys found out who it was and were disappointed, maybe.
Well, there's some merit to that, I guess.
It's just a potential line of thought. I can't say it is absolutely true because DC hasn't really explained why they decided to drop this bombshell all of a sudden. And it is a bit of a bombshell. I really thought this was going to be a driving factor that sells Future State. Who is this guy? How did he get here? You know, the guessing game as to who it could be, since we already knew it was somebody that already existed in DC. I'm just really surprised that they did this a month before it comes out. It's scheduled to go on sale January 5th. I'm a little bit gobsmacked by that one.
I think it would have probably sold more if they left it a mystery.
That would be my opinion on it. I mean, I was personally thinking about picking up an issue or two just to find out who this character was, and now that I know, I'm less interested to go out of my way to pick up something, you know? Mm. But that's me. Meanwhile, also in Future State, Becky Cloonan and Michael Conrad are adding to the Future State slate by a 2-issue Superman Worlds of War anthology. And instead of featuring some of Superman's usual suspects, the Midnighter's going to be in this.
Midnighter?
Yeah.
Wait, oh wow.
Do you remember the character?
I had to think about that for a second, yeah.
Yeah, he was created by Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch in the Stormwatch series as part of a clandestine team that preceded the original Stormwatch. He eventually became a regular part of what was known as the Authority in Wildstorm Comics before the company was bought by DC, and the character was integrated into DC Comics, most notably in, I believe it was in the New 52 when he got his own series. Midnighter is also known as one of DC's biggest LGBTQ characters, who was in a physical relationship with Apollo, who was often called a Superman allegory in DC Comics.
Well, both of them were the allegory for Superman and Batman, and before they got merged into DC, so...
That's correct. However, what set Midnighter apart is that he is not a trained warrior. He has a small computer that's been implanted in his mind that allows him to play out a battle like over 100 times before he even throws his first punch. I'd call it a probability engine, except it's not trying to show him the greatest probability. He's just literally playing it through in his head until he finds the right way through.
So, more like a simulation engine?
That would be a better way to put it. It's not to say he isn't physically capable. He's a guy who seems to fight like he has a plan, but he tends to wing it more often than not. And it's also curious that he's the one showing up in a Future State Superman comic when he probably has some of the least involvement with Kryptonian matters in DC Comics right now. Then again, though, throwing Midnighter in there, that would definitely be a monkey wrench in the way Superman usually operates.
Yeah. He's not very conducive to the whole sparkly, shiny, everything in order.
No, and he makes Batman look measured by comparison.
Yes.
The new regular Wonder Woman writers are starting to preview their plans for after Future State's end. Becky Cloonan and Michael Conrad got some warm-up pitches for their ongoing plans for Diana in Future State Immortal Wonder Woman. According to Cloonan, quote, "When we dove into Immortal Wonder Woman, our first thought was to tell a story about Wonder Woman at the end of time. Who would still be around? What's changed? Through it all, Diana has to redefine who and what she fights for and what it means to her to be a hero." And according to Conrad, quote, "Immortal Wonder Woman is set in the distant future. It is the most future of future states possible. We meet her at the end of everything," unquote. I've never really thought about Diana as being the lone survivor of the DC universe in the far-flung future.
Well, because most times they depict that, it's usually Superman.
Well, it's usually either Superman or Batman standing over at the end of everything. Now, don't get me wrong. Wonder Woman being at the end probably makes the most sense, since she is functionally immortal. You know, she's practically ageless. She doesn't grow very often past a certain point. Physically, I mean. So, I have no truck with that. I'm just not used to people thinking in this way. But, go ahead.
End of time stories is not my thing. It's just so far beyond my ability to grasp. It's like...
it's not far beyond mine, but in my case, it's almost one of the saddest outcomes for DC's heroes. Not because Wonder Woman survived, but because she always depends on defining herself via those people that she saved and the ones that she cares for. So if there's no one left around, who is she? I imagine that's one of the questions they're going to try to answer. So, then again, though, she may not be the only thing left in the universe, since Darkseid is definitely an immortal force of entropy himself. Odds are someone else is there.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the current Catwoman creative team is the same one that's going to be taken back over on the series once Future State ends. Their current creative team of series writer Ram V and artist Fernando Blanco will be back with the series with issue 29 after Future State closes. So there won't be any big shakeups when it comes to Catwoman's current storytelling, which has her leading a gang of what she calls strays in Alleytown, a relatively rundown part of Gotham City. Kind of curious to know what the plan is with her, because it seemed like she and Batman were working really closely until Joker War, and then they just split up. I'm not sure it's enough to make me want to read the comics, though. Last up in DC comic news, there's going to be a third pillar of Batman comics. I mean, the current two pillars are obviously the Batman self-titled series and Detective Comics. After Future State, there will be a new 64-page monthly Batman anthology series called Batman Urban Legends. Evidently, this isn't going to center on Batman necessarily, but some of the other players running around in Gotham City, including Batman, Grifter, Harley Quinn, Poison Ivy, and more. As a matter of fact, the first issue will have a Batman story, a Grifter solo story, and a story about Harley Quinn looking for her sometimes partner, sometimes rival, Poison Ivy, and where their relationship sits currently.
Honestly, when he laid down the subtitle of Urban Legend, I thought it was going to be an anthology series of people who, say, talks about it and were getting a perspective from the citizens.
Now that you said that out loud, I almost want to read that versus this. Because that's the kind of story that we don't usually get in DC. You don't get many stories about how the people in their world view the strange going-ons around them, for the most part, you know? A lot of Marvel characters, they at least have somebody on the outside that they talk to, whether it be an unpowered spouse or just plain friends that they have within their universe. I can't think of anyone Batman's had over for coffee. I'm not even sure. Okay, that's not coffee. That's a cup of coffee. That's a different connotation. It's not something we can get into here. I mean, of this first issue, the only thing I'm really interested in is to find out more about Grifter's story as to why he's in Gotham, why he's been hired to protect the Fox family recently, and what's going on with the Halo Corporation, which was mentioned very shortly in Batman Comics, which implies that the rest of the Wildcats may be somewhere in this universe. And if the Wildcats are active, I don't know what that means. I couldn't imagine what it'd be like if Batman actually met someone like Zealot. Actually, that'd be pretty flashy. That might be cool. Last up is our general comic and convention news. This is where we talk about comic books that are not Marvel or DC related, as well as conventions going on all over the internet. There is no convention news this week, as in prior years we found out, December is a very quiet week for comic book convention news. Nobody's really doing anything, and given the pandemic, I'm sure even less than usual is happening. Unfortunately, though, a comic book artist passed away this past week. Richard Corbin died at 80 after heart surgery. His death was announced by his wife, Donna Corbin. Mr. Corbin died December 2nd. His exact cause of death hasn't been disclosed so far. According to the statement that was released, quote, "Richard was very appreciative of the love for his art that was shown by you, his fans. Your support over the decades means a great deal to him. He tried to repay your support by working diligently on each piece of art going out to you. Although Richard has left us, his work will live on, and his memory will always live in our hearts." Unquote. Apparently, there's still some art of Corbin's that was unsold as of yet that's going to be sold through the Corbin Studios website at corbincomicart.com. It appears that someone will also be managing the process of publishing his work internationally. They look to really get started with this in 2021, so they're not doing anything immediately. Corbin was best known as one of the illustrators on Heavy Metal magazine. He also worked on Warren Publications horror comics like Eerie, Creepy, and Vampirella. It was Vampirella that allowed him to break into the comic book industry back in the 70s. He's also worked on several mainstream superheroes. Corbin's done work on the Hulk, Luke Cage, Ghost Rider, John Constantine, Hellboy, and Conan. He also painted the cover himself to Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell album and the film poster for Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise. In 2012, Corbin was inducted into the Will Eisner Hall of Fame. In 2018, he was given the Angoulême Comics Festival Grand Prix Award and the symbolic presidency of the 2019 festival, featuring a wide-ranging gallery of his work. See, again, this is one of those guys I didn't really hear about, unfortunately, until he passed away, and now I'm sorry, I just didn't know. I would have gone out of my way to meet a guy who's worked that long in the industry. A little sad. Then again, I think out of all of us, I was the only one who ever just kind of flipped through Heavy Metal magazine for fun. Meanwhile, longtime DC exclusive artist Freddie Williams III, he's working on a new creator-owned series called The Bequest. It's for Aftershock Comics. He's working alongside writer Tim Seeley in the issue. The Bequest is about a group of fantasy heroes from another world who go to Chicago, where they must hunt down artifacts and weapons taken from their world before they cause too much destruction. What?
Interesting.
According to the solicit, quote, "Welcome to the high fantasy world of Tengi, a land where wizards and warriors battle dragons in dark and dank dungeons, where thieves pillage ancient ruins and priests answer the audible words of their great gods. Welcome to Chicago, Illinois, where the magical items from Tengi are being traded on the black market and are messing everything up. Now a group of Tengi adventurers must uncover our modern world to stop artifacts and monsters from falling into the wrong hands. But how will they fare in a world without wizards and warriors? A world without heroes," unquote.
So D&D in modern times, but still use the old fantasy tropes.
Yeah, kind of. Got it. D&D on your street, basically.
Yes. Except they're not LARPers.
No. Well, depending on how they go, they might be as effective as, but we'll see. I don't know, that's kind of an interesting premise at the very least. On its face, it sounds a little ludicrous, but then again, so are most comic books.
Yeah. I mean, it's enough to kind of pique my interest a bit.
Well, yeah, and Tim Seeley and Freddie Williams, they are two long-time and veteran DC creators. I mean, it's kind of curious to see what these guys can do when they're let off the editorial chain and are allowed to make new stories, you know? So this could actually be fun. Would you like to see an image of Williams' art? I imagine this is either solicit art or cover art.
Yeah, sure.
If you take a look, when it comes to D&D, it's almost kind of classic there. You can almost sense who is the who's the warrior, who's the thief, who's the rogue.
Mm-hmm.
Which one might breathe fire.
Scary Front looks too much like Wolverine.
You say Wolverine, I say Captain America after a few beers. But Bequest number one is actually due out relatively soon. It's due out March 17th. I might have to keep an eye out for that just to see how this starts.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, another comic is charging into another classic storytelling trope, and this one has to do with kaijus. Writer and artist James Herron is going out with a new comic book in March called Ultra Mega. It's promising giant heroes, creatures, and devastation. Ultra Mega is due out March 17th by Skybound Entertainment and Image Comics. The solicit here reads, quote, "A cosmic plague is spread, transforming everyday people into violent, monstrous kaiju. Only the Ultra Mega, three individuals imbued with incredible powers, hold the line against the madness. Their battles level cities and leave untold horror in their wake. Now, the final reckoning approaches for the Ultra Mega. But is this a war they can even win?" Unquote.
Didn't one of the big two do something like this?
I'm sorry?
Didn't one of the big two do something like this in a story?
Not that I know of. I know that Marvel Comics has a soldier that transforms. He has, like, the American flag tattooed on his lizard body. They call him the American Kaiju.
No, I think they did, a limelight story about it. Or maybe it was just a what-if.
It may have been a what-if. I don't recall this happening in Marvel 616. And DC, yeah. I don't have a basis of information to be able to tell you. I can tell you, based on the description we were talking about, you know, three people who can transform into the Ultra Mega to stop these things, This feels kind of anime.
You said three people, and I, all of a sudden I'm thinking about Rampage.
Well, I don't quite know how this is supposed to go, if people can't control themselves and they transform, or if they're all transformed and cities are just laid to waste. I really don't know. Ultra Mega is scheduled to come out March 17th, 2021. I'm not sure about this one. I applaud the attempt. I do. I just don't know. I don't think I know enough about the story to make an opinion.
Not my thing.
Meanwhile, Grant Morrison is teaming up with longtime writer Donnie Cates for an origin story to an independent comic, and I'm not sure who created it, called Atomahawk. Like Atomic right. Hawk, the words melded together. Atomahawk. Apparently there's also plans for a toy version of the lead character, Cyberzerker. Is everything in this story just two words melded together? They're currently using Kickstarter to put together funds for the Atomahawk toy of the Cyberzerker. Starting to hurt to say these words. Atomahawk was a 2017 serial in Heavy Metal magazine following a sword-wielding apocalyptic warrior on a quest to free his imprisoned god. After it was serialized, Image Comics put out a collected edition of Atomahawk. You know, power to him. I can't say that this particular one is for me. And saying Atomahawk over and over is starting to get a little annoying to me. I can't imagine what it sounds like to you.
I don't know. I'm not that offended by it. I think I should be, but I'm not.
I didn't say offended. It's just annoying.
I'm not annoyed by it.
Okay, so let's change gears. Are you an Avatar The Last Airbender fan?
Yes.
How would you feel about a graphic novel revolving around one of the side characters in the original series?
Which one?
Well, it appears that Nickelodeon Publications is putting out a solo OGN for fan-favorite character Suki.
Yes.
They're calling it Avatar The Last Airbender, Suki Alone. Writer Faith Erin Hicks, who's previously done other Avatar OGNs, is returning. She's working with artist Peter Wortman. And they're going to chart Suki's course when she's captured by the Fire Nation and placed in a special prison beneath a dormant volcano dubbed the Boiling Rock. So we may actually get the story as to how she ended up in that prison where she was eventually found, I want to say, early in the third season? Or early in the third book?
No, late.
Late in the third book, okay.
Late, past the halfway point.
All right. Suki was originally introduced as one of the Kyoshi Warriors, a clan of fighters who base their style and looks on previous Avatar Kyoshi from the same village. So, this is one of those things where it takes a deft writer, because someone has to fill in the gaps on a story that's already very well established. And while Suki was never exactly a central player, even when she was introduced and eventually started to work closely with Aang and Sokka and Katara, she still didn't feel like a very big part of the story. You know?
Everyone's still excited to see her.
I think that this is Nickelodeon's chance to really build in on a missed opportunity to telling her story. Last up in general comic and convention news, the success of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles The Last Ronin already has Kevin Eastman and Tom Waltz working on prequels and sequels to the miniseries. Not only are they working on it, they're working on R-rated versions of it to match the grittiness of The Last Ronin itself. According to Tom Waltz, quote, "Not gonna lie, Kevin and I are already talking about this very thing. It's like 2011 all over again. We started a new TMNT universe, and we are psyched up, motivated, and itching to do more, given the chance," unquote. I mean, if it's working for him, it's working for him. You know, The Last Ronin is definitely the Dark Knight for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fans. It's the same kind of dystopian feel, the same kind of lone survivor type item. And hopefully they can build the kind of story that they need so that it really does propagate the world enough to require prequels and sequels. I don't know how The Last Ronin's going to end, but the story of the fall of the turtles that did not survive would probably be a pretty good story in and of itself. What do you think?
Definitely going to be a sad one.
Oh, but, I mean, how could it not be sad already? There's one guy talking to himself all the time. And we've only hit the first issue, and they're already talking about tie-in issues. The second issue of Last Ronin is scheduled to go on sale January 27th. It's been a while since a comic book caused this much speculation, you know?
Yeah.
So, I wish him the best. I do. Well, the subject of this week is Batman and Gotham City. How does it work? And I know we don't usually do suppositional stuff on this. We usually do conversations based on existing comic book stories or even projected futures of those stories. In this case, it's more of a for fun conversation since we're coming up on the end of the year. I do think that we're going to end up taking a little bit of time off, and I figured it'd be fun to just go ahead and send out the type of conversations that you could have with other friends about how certain things in comic books would end up working in sort of real-world and non-real-world scenarios. And before we, what do you think, Jesse? Should we talk more about Batman first or about Gotham City? I know, it's a hard question.
I'd rather talk about Gotham City first.
Okay. That's fair. Because Gotham City obviously is a place with a lot of problems. So, let's start with its location. Gotham City is a bay town. It has a port, so that means there's a lot of trade and commerce coming through there. However, right. We also know, based on writing, that Gotham is based in the state of New Jersey in the United States. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I always thought it was another New York place.
Well, that's Metropolis. Metropolis is the shining city across the river in New York.
Hmm.
So, yeah, Gotham would have a decent amount of money and imports and exports coming through it, you would think.
Yeah.
However, it always seems to me that unless you're in very specific neighborhoods, Gotham always looks like it's about two payments away from missing its mortgage and is about to be foreclosed.
Yeah.
So it's pretty obvious that there's not a lot of urban development in Gotham City, not a lot of people investing in real estate or buildings, unless, of course, it happens to be an abandoned amusement park and there happens to be a clown face over the over the House of Horrors, then usually somebody tends to pick it up, it seems like.
There's a surprisingly large amount of those in Gotham City.
You're right, there's a lot of abandoned buildings out there that gets co-opted by somebody.
And toy factories.
You know, I guess by that nature, who's going to inspect these buildings? Do you want to be the guy that walks in and suddenly finds yourself surrounded by 30 goons who are dressed up like toys?
And that's another aspect. How are this... there are that many people that many people to be hired up as goons for all the various
I don't know. We've talked about this in private a couple times. The employment in Gotham City must be horrible. I don't know if it's a lack of jobs or a lack of well-paying jobs, but considering how often people become henchmen and then they and their bosses are beat up by a maniac in a bat suit and occasionally a child in a red and green suit. And yet there always seems to be another person starting a gang and enough people to fill out that gang. So that tells me that money is kind of hard to come by in Gotham if people are willing to regularly risk their lives versus the psycho in the bat suit.
You know, I'm thinking about this now and I'm like, yeah, a lot of these things get beat the hell up. Makes me wonder, it's like, how's the health insurance for these people, if any?
Well, it's got to be awful, because we're just contending with the idea that the henchmen would have to fight Batman. What about the people who are working for those individuals who are so psychotic, they get their faces slammed into teddy bears filled with barbed wire, or frozen solid, or occasionally shot twice, because their boss does not shoot once? So people are still taking these jobs, even with these inherent risks, working for psychopathic individuals. I mean, granted, the American lifestyle cannot be sustained by fast food jobs. I mean, and I'm not saying the jobs are menial, I'm saying that fast food jobs are not paid enough to be able to make a living. However, even then, I would gladly flip burgers before I work for the Joker or the Penguin.
Yeah, I mean, they get to choose between two. I probably would do Penguin.
If it's a choice between just those two, yeah, the Penguin's definitely the lesser of two evils. Except, if the job goes well, you still smell like fish all day. I guarantee it.
Yeah, well, working at the burger place always smelled like fries, so.
least it's something I'd want to eat. But still. Okay, so the employment in Gotham would have to be atrocious for people to go back that often.
Yes.
Then there's the idea of what. Actually, it just occurred to me, where's the money in Gotham going? There's several large corporations that have headquarters in Gotham City, depending on which era of DC Comics you're talking about. I would imagine at the best point was probably the period where you had, of course, the Wayne Foundation corporate headquarters, and I believe LexCorp also owned a tower in the city for quite a while.
Well, you gotta imagine most of the actually blue collar will probably be in the shipping area.
No, I'm not talking about blue collar. I just mean generally in the form of funds and money, because while those businesses are probably given tax breaks, knowing the way American businesses work when they're basing themselves, they would still be bringing a certain amount of money in and out of the city. So where is that money going? How can you have multinational corporations that appear to supply almost nothing to the communities themselves? I mean, LexCorp, granted, the guy in charge is a gallivanting supervillain. He's not going to give back to the communities. So that leaves the Wayne Enterprises, which I suppose most of their free money is going into creating a military-industrial complex for Batman himself. Look, I know people are listening to this going, you guys are going getting way too complicated about this, but we're honestly just trying to understand how Gotham City can function as is, because it's always depicted in DC as the city on a brink of a major breakdown. And as of the last few issues of Batman, it had that breakdown. It had Joker War. And now the city is starting to rebuild, and it just begs the question is, why? Why is it rebuilding? Why is it rebuilding when there's always a cloud of Joker gas, or the city's getting frozen, or for some reason plants are growing through the ground and they're sending out pheromones that make you fall in love with a weird redhead, or the bouncing albino woman with blonde hair with the tips colored who's always swinging a hammer? Why do people live in this city?
They gave an answer, and we call BS.
But now, sorry.
As I, it, the reason they gave is dumb and stupid and backward thinking. It's like if this were the 80s, yeah, I would buy it because that was the kind of mindset at the time.
I guess that's kind of some of the weakness of the current concepts we're running into is that they are based on very old concepts from, at best, the 60s, as to the nature of the criminal mind. I mean, there was a long-term assumption, even into the 80s, that basically said people got into crime because they were too stupid or too lazy to hold a job. And now we're at a point where we know that the truth behind the matter is way more complicated than that. Sometimes it's just last-ditch attempt to save a home or save a family. Other people, you know, they may not feel they have a choice because they're former convicts. May not even be related to any sort of super crime in Gotham, but maybe they just made a mistake and businesses see them as unhirable and they ran out of options. There's always going to be opportunists or thrill seekers out there who see this as a way to just have fun. Not every person is somebody who's down on their luck, but there's the way Gotham is built, odds are a lot of the people who fall in with Batman's Rogues Gallery are not evil, they're just having problems.
They're desperate.
I would think so. I mean, how many more of them may be just people with undiagnosed mental health issues who seriously need help? Actually, a perfect example of that might be Punchline herself. Who could she have been if she had had therapy instead of just following the Joker's teachings or ideologies or what have you?
Yeah, well, that might be prone until, society kind of figures it out. I know there are a lot of people that say this and this, but the people who can make things move are not accepting that. It's too complicated for them. They want something simple.
Yeah. That's a problem with American society in general, is that we try to oversimplify problems when they may have a multitude of causes.
Yeah, and then they want one size catches all for whatever process, including like school and education. It's like, I've had many discussions with colleagues and friends that how it's not one size fits all is going to help anyone.
No, that's very true. That is very true. I guess another question I would have in regards to Gotham is, what are the real estate values there? There's a lot of buildings, but like you said, there's always a number of larger buildings that seem to be empty because they're always being inhabited by odds and ends and various people. But what's it like to own a home out there?
Their homes.
I meant somebody lives there.
Well, yeah, I imagine like apartments and whatnot, not actual homes.
There may be actual homes. The city itself seems to be stylized like a New Jersey, New York town where, you know, we live out in California. We're used to thinking of homes as places with yards and a little bit of space. Out there, it's probably more like buildings. You know, brownstones, things like that.
Something from San Francisco, maybe even.
Possibly. But at the same time, what are home values like? If there's that kind of regular devastation out there, what kind of value can you actually assign to a house? It almost seems guaranteed that every 5 years you're going to have to make a move, either because part of your floor's been shattered, there's a Batmobile sitting in the wall, or fire.
Some form of disaster, natural or otherwise.
I was thinking Firefly, but okay. Still, though, I have trouble picturing what the properties would be worth if they're torn down on such a regular basis. And which leads, I guess, to another question of mine is, who's rebuilding the city? Someone has to be putting things back up after somebody knocks them down. And we are talking about a city that regularly has something that looks a lot like a tank driving through it.
Maybe DC needs their own version of, was it damage control?
Sean Murphy tried to answer that a little bit himself in his Murphyverse, the Batman Black and White com no, the Batman White Knight comics. In that series, it turns out that it was the Wayne Foundation was annually donating about $1.3 billion to the city of Gotham in the form of the Batman Destruction Fund. You would think
You know,
somebody, oh, sorry.
I was going to say that it sounds like it's something that was kind of alluded to in many years ago, but I think it's just a straight up forgotten or just abandoned.
I don't read enough Batman comics to know. Unfortunately, I can speak more in general concepts when it comes to these stories.
And that's what I'm speaking to because I barely read any Batman as well. Most of my Batman knowledge has been discussions with you and on in our podcast or whatever I watched as a child back in the 90s.
Okay, so you're misinformed. I get it. I get it. Okay, another question I have. And this is something that's actually started to bother me since we talked about having this discussion. Gotham City's police force. Okay, so in just about every story I read, even currently, a lot of Gotham City's beat cops just, they look like beat cops. They look like guys you'd find on most East Coast cities with a standard police gear attached to them. Now, while that as a concept feels fine, it occurs to me that with the history Gotham City has, why isn't each beat cop dressed up like a SWAT soldier? That is an honest question of mine. Why don't they have tactical helmets, maybe a rifle as they walk the streets, you know, long combat boots laced up? Why aren't they ready to go? Because it seems like the weirdest things happen here. On
I think
frightening with frightening regularity.
I might have an answer. I don't think you might find it acceptable. It's that they're trying to maintain a particular image for Gotham, and it's very old kind of image.
Do you mean in story or do you mean editorially?
In
I didn't mean to break you with a question. I'm trying to understand.
Oh, I'm trying to understand the difference between the two.
Okay, so what I'm asking is, do you think there's an in-story reason for it? Do you think it's a case where
Oh no,
they just
no,
decided
definitely
that
that.
Gotham City police think it's fine, or do you think editorial may have missed the idea that maybe these guys are in over their heads?
Editorial.
Okay. Yeah, I'm really kind of surprised that Gotham Police is not the militarized nightmare that we work so hard to try to avoid in the United States. If there's any place that actually needs an overarmed police force, it seems like Gotham. And that's really saying something considering the type of issues Metropolis deals with on the regular.
And actually, this is another conversation I've had with another friend, but he came to the conclusion that Joker should not be alive. And not because Batman keeps letting him live, it's just like the city or the state should have just outright killed him regardless of his mental state because of the level of drugs he's constantly put out.
I mean, I know the in-story reason is because he's clinically insane and you cannot enforce the death penalty on legally insane individuals.
He's a repeat offender of massive collateral damage and loss of life that he's just a danger and a threat to everyone.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would say death penalty necessarily, and I'm speaking as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be okay if the next time he was incarcerated, he was placed in like a chemical coma. Just knock him completely out. Leave him there until you understand what you're doing with his neurological makeup, you know? Because he definitely needs to be completely incapacitated.
Yes.
You know, there's several criminals that just are confusing me by their very existence. Joker is definitely one of them. Poison Ivy is up there, not because she's evil necessarily, but because her impulse control is so bad, she still destroys things with frightening regularity. Mr. Freeze also confounds me.
He does, only because they kind of retroactively made him insane again.
They've done a number of things with him, although the recent stories show that his wife is crazier than he is. They awoke her recently.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that kind of stuff, and then that's not counting some of the more random items and people who just kind of breeze through Gotham on a regular basis. So, oddly, I think we've already covered a lot of the stranger items about Gotham City. Oddly enough, I think we've already covered a lot of the major areas of Gotham City and the ways it could potentially function. But, I mean, I don't even know good suggestions on how to fix it. You've got a lot of very, very high-powered and capable individuals who seem intent on, if not taking over large segments of the city, entirely annihilating it simply because it annoys them on some level.
Or amuses them.
Yeah, and I don't really know which is which on a given time. So I don't know how you fix it unless you beef up the police force. There's something to be said about the police should be able to handle more issues than they're able to handle per the writing that DC's given them so far. They always seem to be way in over their heads until Batman shows up.
You know, what was I think a good direction toward that is when Jim Gordon had that bat suit.
It wasn't the best design, but it was an interesting turn having a Batman that actually worked directly with the police.
Yes.
You know, it needed refinement. It was a good story that never really got the depth I think it needed. So, let's flip this conversation to Gotham's Guardian. The Batman himself, and we'll include the Bat family in this for the sake of argument, because you know that when you're discussing Batman and his tactics, sooner or later you have to discuss the result of those tactics, and that's characters like Nightwing, Robin, and Red Hood, and Batgirl, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I know this is going to be a big statement to start out, but I would classify Batman's mission as a very big failure. And I know that sounds harsh because he's one of the preeminent comic book heroes of all time in the United States, if not globally. But Batman's mission is not doing what it's supposed to do. Crime in Gotham only ever seems to escalate. It never actually seems to hit a plateau point or a receding point. It just seems to be getting worse. And with the exception of a few very careful pieces of writing, I don't think Bruce Wayne does enough to answer the root issues of crime in the city. He just responds to it as it's happening for the most part.
Well, I think the main problem is you need to figure out his root problem.
That's a fair point. He definitely has some neuroses that are affecting the way he sees the world and everything else around him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never gotten over it. Even though he's turned into a grown man, even though he's a billionaire, even though he's a highly trained martial artist, he still never really dealt well with the initial trauma that has caused this entire issue. He's more or less spent a lifetime avoiding it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, instead of actually trying to, he spent a while understanding criminology, criminal behaviors, and he's definitely formed an information system that allows him to see into the general underworld of Gotham City. But yeah, he's never really bothered to find out why people need to turn to crime. I mean, characters like the Joker, Two-Face, and the Penguin, they would lose a lot of their effectiveness if you could just find a way to keep henchmen from following their commands.
And the thing is, and I'm under the belief that he has actually the power to fix that. It's not as Batman.
So you're talking like philanthropy, Bruce Wayne, Wayne Foundation, all that, right?
Yeah, actually buy into his alter ego.
That's a fair point. It's hard to argue that because you're right, monetarily, at least before Joker War anyway, he was in a unique position to actually affect more social change in his communities rather than just jumping on top of people and beating them around the skull.
And if need be, he could be provide funding or tech or knowledge or know-how or training to help to see, better handle and deal with it.
That would almost be an interesting story. I think you tripped across a story that might actually be sellable to DC. If you created a new series called The Gotham Knights, and it was just people that Bruce Wayne hired as Bruce Wayne to try to understand and counteract the criminal elements, just say a bunch of people who have worked with several criminals or just some people who have run in the right circles to feed him new information. And find ways to fully engage with these people instead of, again, brutalizing them at the first opportunity. You know, that would almost be an interesting way to attack what's going on in the city without actually having to beat it up.
And here's the thing, and I feel bad for saying this because I like Barbara Gordon as Oracle, but he can be the Oracle for
Yes.
Gotham City, the Information Network. The guy, he himself could be his own forensic institution.
But that would require him to stop being Batman, which appears to be the only form of therapy he really has, unfortunately.
It's not good
I
therapy.
didn't say it was good. It's almost like an allegory to people who are self-medicating when they have a neurological issue. Instead of listening to their doctor, they're picking up whatever illicit substance makes them feel good in the moment, and that's the way they're coping with life. Maybe they're functional, but it's not really healthy. And unfortunately for Bruce Wayne, his coping mechanism is beating people up. And I know that sounds oversimplified, but realistically, when you think about Batman's adventures, his effect on the city, and how he stops people, he really fails to deal with a lot of his internal traumas, or even the traumas of a lot of his major villains, or even the henchmen he comes across. He is a punch first, figure it out later person. And that's not helpful. Okay, it's helpful when you're a professional boxer, but it's not helpful when you're trying to save a city. If you disagree with me, please let me know. This is a discussion. I am not trying to take over.
The thing is, every time this comes, I find myself just hating this idea, this notion they keep putting out you and Joanne. It bothers me so much because for me, the ideal version of Batman I've always had in my brain was from the animated series where he did think about the people and try to help them or try to help those criminals.
Well, I think that's the most annoying thing about the current level of comics is that I think we can all agree that Bruce Wayne does have the capability to actually begin, if not enact, major change within Gotham, but he keeps getting stuck with writers and artists who are trying to make the next pinup moment in the comic books rather than what Wayne can do to affect Gotham City largely. Before Joker War started, we were talking about James Tynion, who's taken over the writing for Tom King. And he was talking about rebuilding Gotham after the City of Bane arc. And one of the first things he did was build a new holding facility underneath GCPD to hold super criminals. Which is a fine concept, but you're still not handling the problems at large in Gotham. You're just handling what happens when you throw those problems in jail for the umpteenth time. As a matter of fact, you know, that would be another way to actually help the city, would be to make Arkham a functional place for people to get better instead of the place they sit until they feel like escaping again.
Yeah, well, I think the other problem is like there are other. I feel like if you want to really delve into this, there are other factors in Gotham other than the criminal, super criminal element that's holding it back, and that might be the other, the other 1 percenters that are just trying to keep their position and spot in the city.
Oh, I'm not saying that what's going on in the city is entirely on Bruce Wayne's shoulders. However, it's just easier to talk about him because so many people make him the focus of what could fix Gotham City.
And I think it would be an interesting story if he's trying, if you push him in that element where he's trying to fix it, fix the root problem, and he's being hung up by not the criminals or super criminals, but the Gotham alumni.
You know, that would be a good way to redeploy some of the Robins, actually, like Tim Drake or Dick Grayson,
Or Frank Drake.
to infiltrate the higher ranks of society to understand things.
And, you know, in for all New 52 did, I liked the Corps of Owls was a neat idea which could fit into this story.
Potentially, yeah, but I mean, it's just so easy to come back around to he punches it in the face and he wins. Which is largely a Batman story. It's kind of brought down to two sentences. And then there's the other problem in that Gotham regularly goes through these Armageddon level events, something that can almost physically wipe the city off the map, if not have it visibly on fire for everyone to see. And yet, they live across the river from a city that has the Kryptonian in it. I know Bruce Wayne is too egotistical to ask for help, but that usually doesn't stop Superman from getting involved in things when he feels it's necessary.
Yeah, well, I've seen some stories and panels where Batman outright kicks him out.
Yeah, and I know the City of Bane storyline, they had hostages and everything, but at the same time, it feels really odd how the villains of Gotham City seem to countermand all the other heroes. And there's got to be almost thousands of them by now in the DC universe. I mean, if Superman can't make it, where's Wonder Woman? She and Batman speak a lot on the Justice League. Why doesn't she show up?
And Flash is never too far away from any one place on Earth.
He's one of the characters that confounds me the most because, yeah, in a couple blinks, he could be across the country. So why is it every time that something blows up in Gotham, Bruce Wayne stands up, he turns around, and then there's the Flash standing there, just dropping two guys, got it, and runs away?
This is why I feel like Batman's best served as a detective in noir story instead of being super heroics.
Well, it was kind of inevitable once DC started to meld its characters together that there would be some crossover there, except Batman. I think early on in those team-ups, Batman always had a not in Gotham rule for whatever reason. I don't know if it's ego or just he feels like it's his responsibility or what. But as the comics get further and further along and DC's characters get more and more powered and or capable, those rules have just been, I don't know, blurred. It seems like they're starting to show up in Gotham on a regular basis. So it really confounds me why Batman slash Bruce Wayne will not. Even if he doesn't ask for more assistance, why he doesn't allow it to occur. The Joker could be solved really quickly if you would ask some of your superpowered cohorts for help. Hell, even the Martian Manhunter can make a tremendous difference in Gotham if you would work with him instead of constantly shunning him and pretending you can do this by yourself, even though you have a cadre of kids you keep training to help you.
In all honesty, I think it's a matter of ego that he's a this is you know he has to fix this. It's his job, and that plays into the odd psychosis he has.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you there because I have a large amount of agreement for that assessment. But there are other people who, you know what? Actually, that touches on one other thing that's kind of odd about Bruce Wayne, Batman, however you want to refer to him, is that he spends all of his time training these proteges. Dick, Tim, Jason, Barbara, Damian, Duke, and in a lesser form, Luke and Tim Fox, right? He spends a lot of time training these people, showing them how to do what he does, inviting them to help, but every time he finds himself in over his head, he is very reluctant to often call on these people for help. Why is that? They're supposed to be some of the best trained people in DC. Are they the best fighters? No, but to handle the issues in Gotham, they're usually more than adequate. So if you go through the trouble of making them into mini-Us, why don't you allow them to help? Doesn't that feel odd?
And I think it's another ego thing.
I don't doubt that either. I don't get why you put that effort into them. Watch them grow up. Watch them put on different costumes. Watch them turn into people who are proud to wear the bat symbol. And then, unless the city itself is about to turn into cinders, you don't talk to them.
It can also be a writer problem, too.
Yeah, so. and before anyone out there starts sending a bunch of messages, I understand that there are stories where he does actually call for help. However, it does seem to be a long-term character flaw in Batman in that he doesn't call for help until he is well in over his cowl. And that happens more often than you would think for somebody who's supposed to be the peak human in DC.
Yeah, being peak human doesn't let you go against super-powered, take your pick of what.
No, and that's kind of another flaw that a lot of people overlook when it comes to Batman, is that if he was without his utility belt for a lot of his adventures, he would have been strung up by his ears a long time ago. You know, he's very fortunate to be very well armed.
Yeah, like, in all honesty, of his rogue scouters, I can only think of two off the top of my head that should be way beyond his capabilities.
Clayface would probably be one of them.
Oh, that's three.
If he was without his gear, Killer Croc, I think, would be a problem too.
True. I was thinking more along the lines of Poison Ivy and Mr. Freeze, but
yeah, both of those would be very difficult if he didn't have his utility belt. And he can outmaneuver them physically. However, it always comes down to devices that he has and or created ahead of time to ensure his survivability versus those characters. So, look, I've had long-term issues with the character of Batman because the more you look into him, the more the concept falls apart. And I am not doing this to be mean. I am not doing this to denigrate anyone's likings. I will probably still pick up issues of Batman here and there just to find out what the character is up to. But unfortunately, with the proliferation of superheroes in DC, Batman turns into a little bit of a redundant character. One who demands that people stay out of his stuff, even though he is proving time and time again that he's barely holding things together out there before another neighborhood falls apart. You got any questions you want to add or anything? Because I'm not trying to rant. I'm just trying to lay it out as evenly as I can.
I am just frustrated that Batman is not as cohesive as it should be.
What do you mean by cohesive?
I'm finding the wrong words. I like that. I still do, but the over-the-top storylines and abilities they've given is just so tiring.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes him less and makes him less that he's capable of doing these things when his motif is he is just a man.
Okay. I can understand that. And even then, it's getting more and more defined, even by DC's writers, that Batman is an extremely flawed man.
And I'm actually okay with him being a flawed man. It's just him overcoming things that no human should be able to do.
Okay. As a matter of fact, I finished the latest Batman arc ahead of Future State. I mentioned that at the top of the show. And the Ghostmaker appeared as of issue 100 at the end, and in issue 101 he was in Gotham City. And think of him like a counterforce to Batman. He's somebody who's also trying to save the world by extreme means, except his version of extreme means is to infiltrate a city, and instead of trying to turn criminals or find their ways up the criminal ladder, He literally brutalizes and kills everybody before he leaves a town.
Sounds like Punisher?
More elegant than that, he's created his personal computer system called the GhostNet, which apparently is so adept it can hack Barbara Gordon's systems without her being aware that it occurred.
And that's another thing I don't like with DC's writing, that stupid stuff like that.
Okay, so here's the thing, though. The Ghostmaker, after Joker War, is convinced that the deal he made with Batman, I don't know how many years ago, it was back when Dick Grayson was still a small Robin, was that he would honor Batman's wishes because the two of them had come to blows several times and stay out of Gotham, but he could set up camp anywhere else he wanted to. Now the Joker War is complete, Ghostmaker is convinced that Batman's mission is a failure and he's going to go in and show him how to do it. So he has started to actually, like, operate in Gotham City, killed several leftover Joker henchmen, raided a couple of their safe houses and where they hang out. And Batman was not incensed, but he was so worried about this that he kind of dropped everything in that moment to go find Ghostmaker. And Ghostmaker himself was actually hunting Clown Hunter, another lethal vigilante, somebody he was convinced that could not be saved because he's murdering Joker henchmen with every opportunity he gets, right? And Clown Hunter's decided that his latest target is going to be one Harleen Quinzel, who's recently moved back into Gotham. So, after a fight, it turns out Batman is finally starting to work his way up criminal ladders. The reason why he hadn't dispatched or dealt with several of the villains Ghostmaker already did, sorry, mixing up names, was that because he was working on investigations to work their way up the ladders of these criminals so he could figure out who's in charge of these operations. So Batman is actually thinking more globally than he has been in several storylines thus far, right? So, Ghostmaker had enough of the conversation. He darted Harley Quinn, Clown Hunter, and Batman, and he tied them all up in Arkham. He left Clown Hunter without restraint, so when Clown Hunter got up, he saw a sword and he wanted to cut Harley Quinn's head off because Quinn was actually there when the Joker murdered his parents. And I don't remember how, but Batman managed to get a batarang to Quinn, who used it to cut her own bonds free before this kid could cut her head off, which to me means that this kid is the slowest with a sword I've ever seen.
Lots of plot conveniences.
Not just plot conveniences. That means that at the end of the last issue, he was holding up the sword ready to cut, and then that gave Batman enough time to sit up, yell Quinn's name, toss a batarang for Quinn to catch, cut free of one of her restraints, if not all of them, and then roll out of the way while this kid still has a sword over his head. I mean, you are slow. There must be a time dilation area of effect somewhere in this room for him to be that slow. But Quinn convinces the kid not to touch him, which causes Ghostmaker to intervene again. He and Batman fight to a point. And then Batman, after, a mid-fight conversation, drops the sword he's fighting with and tells Ghostmaker he doesn't want to do this anymore. And then, remember I said Ghostmaker debuted in a cameo in 100? He came in issue 101. We're talking issue 105 right now, right? By the end of this issue, Ghostmaker has agreed to stop blocking Batman's computers, to allow Barbara Gordon into his ghost net, to resume their communications, and he's agreed to stay in Gotham City under the rules that he doesn't kill people, and he continues to call out Bruce Wayne when he thinks he's doing something wrong because, as Bruce says, he hasn't had somebody do that for him since Alfred died. So by the end of this first storyline involving Ghostmaker, he's turned Ghostmaker into a, I don't know, crime-fighting rival, buddy, foil. I was so disappointed because I thought Ghostmaker coming in, we were going to have 2 years' worth of stories about, say, Batman finds out about a crime and he's got to hurry up and get there before Ghostmaker shows up and kills everybody. I thought we were going to have a major paradigm shift. Instead, we've got somebody else who's going to be Batman's latest Red Hood, I guess.
Kind of defanged this character real quickly.
Yes, it did. And I was just in awe about how quickly all this occurred. Now, it occurs to me that maybe editorial forced James Tynion IV to speed up his writing on this story because they had to put the Batman series on hiatus for a month or so for future state. Maybe he had to speed it up, but at the same time, it really feels like you've spent a long time disrupting the status quo to return us to something fairly close to status quo.
Do you have a history of doing that?
Yeah, and the only thing that's really changed since Joker War is that now Ghost Hunter's in town, and technically Ghost Hunter has more money than Bruce Wayne does at this point. That's the big change. I I was so let down. I mean, I haven't really purchased more than one or two Batman comics since Joker War ended. I was curious to see how that story went. But 105 really feels like a good jump-out point to me. Because if things are going to go back to that close to normal that quickly, I don't need to continue. I can pick it up in another year and see where things are. You know what I mean? And that's another problem with Batman when it comes to DC Comics on a whole, is that Batman's mission has not really changed since Frank Miller turned over the apple cart so many years ago.
Yeah, and did an Elseworld story, too.
Yeah. Yeah, Frank Miller really succeeded in redesigning the Batman. He was no longer like the Caped Crusader. He wasn't a relatively jovial or happy-go-lucky character. He was tortured, and he's been tortured since the 90s. There really needs to be a kind of a shake-up on the entire concept of Batman to make it function today. I mean, another thing that occurs to me is that every time someone snaps a picture of the Batman, you have to wonder how much like social media facial rec will suddenly tell you who that is under the cowl. Gotta admit, it's a possibility nowadays.
Yeah.
So it seems like Batman's entire mission should be modified, if not changed. But I think that's a conversation for another day. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on when it comes to Gotham and Batman? Because I'm all ears. The only thing we didn't really discuss in great detail would be Barbara herself. And
well, Barbara herself is kind of an anomaly within the Batman's world.
Why? Because she's a person?
Yes.
You know, Barbara, and this is going to sound really odd, but Barbara should really be in charge of that clan. She's the only one that seems to really care about them, in and out of the mask. She's the only one that really seems to have a sense as to planning for the future that doesn't necessarily mean a new version of handcuffs. And she's the only one that really seems to want to see their lives improve. I don't know if I said that the correct way, but it feels correct. As well as Barbara's the one that engages the most with the city. And I don't mean computers. I mean, she actually cares about the neighborhoods and the citizens within it. You know, Tim and Dick Grayson, they're nice enough people, but they're swashbucklers. There's something about them that enjoys the devil-may-care life. But Barbara, I think Barbara's the one who's most likely to actually engage in the city, go to restaurants and things like that. And I think the current stories with her working in a senator's office kind of mirrors that idea. You know, Joker War left her kind of broken. She's not going to be in a mask for a while, it seems like. But she's back to doing Oracle duty. So she's back to being the lady in the chair.
Which is not terrible. Everyone liked her when she was there.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with that. I just wonder how long it's going to last, because now with Stephanie Brown and Cassandra Cain in pseudo-Batgirl outfits, also cool, by the way, there's always going to be that itch in the back of DC fans' heads as to when Barbara's going to put on a mask again. I don't think she needs to.
No.
But I want to thank you for the conversation. This has been fun. I think we've actually, not uncovered, but we've kind of poked at the edges of some stuff that's been bothering me for a while.
Oh, it's also, you know, pulled the covers off me, because I'll be honest, I still like Batman. I have that ideal image in my head, but man, it's hard to enjoy some of the stories nowadays.
It really can be. I mean, if I lived in Gotham, I would be afraid of my mailbox. I would be convinced I would be that unlucky guy who opens it up and just like, okay, so that's my Sports Illustrated. Bill, green envelope with a question mark on it. What's this about? Oh, no.
Honestly, if I were in Gotham City, I'd be hitchhiking to Central City.
I'm sorry. I'm just picturing some federal trial. Somebody was just sentenced for something. He's just like, I can do this no problem. So where are you putting me? We're sending you to Blackgate. Where's that? Gotham. Oh, just kill me. This is cruel and unusual. You should kill me.
Yeah, because let's be honest, Central City, mostly you have to deal with his car alarms because his rogues galleries are nowhere near as vicious or
No,
psychotic.
you'd have to deal with more than car alarms. You just be sure every time you're looking in a mirror, you're looking at yourself and not somebody else.
The glass makers right there will be big business there.
Central City, where Green Lantern hangs out, that may be one of the quietest cities in DC, frankly. I know it's been wiped off the map once or twice, but when it comes to overall life expectancy, it's not like a whole lot happens in the city.
Oh, I think I may have chose the wrong city.
Why?
I was looking for Flash's town. I forget which one that one is.
That's Central City.
Oh, Central. Oh, they're both there?
No, Flash is Central City. Coast City is where the Green Lantern hangs out.
Yeah, okay.
So, Coast City, like I said, it's been destroyed a couple times, but overall it's messed with the least. You could go hang out in the cities where Aquaman's been, like San Diego and in Massachusetts, but you have to deal with the occasional high tide, and I'm not that type of person.
Well, maybe we should go to Bloodhaven then.
A Gotham suburb? Are you insane?
That's a suburb of Gotham?
Yes.
Oh, never mind. I thought it was like some Chicago ripoff.
No, Bloodhaven and Burnside are both subsections of Gotham.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, not places to go. Come to glorious Gotham Bay. Have fun in the sun. Watch out for the dead whale. Jeez. All of a sudden, the map of Gotham, or all of a sudden, the map of DC's United States, you can't even hang out in the Midwest. I mean, occasionally Smallville probably has the strangest things happen in it, too. Let's just go to Montana. Nothing happens in Montana. I say that, and all of a sudden, Darkseid drops a volcano on it or something. I don't know.
Got St. Mount Hale in there.
You're not helping my Zen.
There's already a volcano there.
All right. Well, we are going on hiatus for a couple of weeks. We have people heading out in different directions for holiday gatherings, and it's kind of hard to propagate a show when everybody has business. But we will be back with more stories. We still have the first volume of Bitterroot on tap for reading, and I'm interested to check that one out because it's very different from what we usually do. And by the time we come back, I'm sure several other stories will have advanced a bit. So, in the meantime, everybody out there, have a happy holiday no matter what you celebrate. Stay safe out there because even though the vaccine is getting distributed, it's still kind of rough to be out and about. And I hope everybody has a nice, nice holiday. Thank you very much. Have a great one. I am Jeremy.
And I am Jesse.
The Cosmic Library is now closed.